Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on our lives. Well, today, leading off, we're going to talk about the fact that the United States has passed a grim milestone. Over 160,000 people have perished because of the coronavirus. And some epidemiologists are claiming that by the end of the year, the death total could exceed 300,000 people by the end of this year. And a new crisis is emerging. Children, college students, should they be allowed to go to college and to schools, given the fact that we are in the middle of a huge second wave pandemic? And also, why is it that children in the main are more or less susceptible to the virus than adults? We're beginning to tease apart some of the mysteries of the coronavirus. And winter is coming. This means the third wave may also hit. When you go back to the year 1918, you realize that it was in September of 1918, at the beginning of the winter season, when everyone is all huddled together in close quarters. That's when their second wave hit. For us, it could be a third wave. Are we going to see a third wave come winter time? And on top of all this chaos caused by the coronavirus, we got hit by a hurricane. In fact, meteorologists are saying that this year, 2020, could come down as one of the worst hurricane seasons in many decades. What's behind it? Is it just an anomaly, or does it have something to do with global warming? Brace yourself, because this could be one of the worst hurricane seasons in memory. Well, let's just jump right into some of the big stories of the past week. The top story is that the United States has now passed yet another grim milestone. It is leading the world in terms of infections and deaths. 160,000 U.S. citizens and residents have died as a consequence of the coronavirus. And the second wave, which we're now in, the second wave in certain parts of the country is even worse than the first wave. And some epidemiologists running the numbers through computers estimate that by the end of 2020, the death total in the United States could exceed 300,000 people. Now, because of this, many people are wondering, should our children and college students be allowed to go back to school? Now, what's causing a lot of anxiety among educators is a new report coming from South Korea. It's perhaps the most definitive report done on the contagiousness of school children. First of all, they analyzed 6,000 families and children, and they did contact tracing with 60,000 contacts of these 6,000 individuals. They very carefully sorted through the data, and they found out several things. First of all, as expected, children are less susceptible to getting the virus and coming down with symptoms than adults. However, they can carry the virus to adults. In fact, from the age of 10 to 19, children can spread the virus just as well as adults who are infected. Now, that is a tremendous fact that scientists are still digesting. In other words, a child may be totally asymptomatic, but is as infectious as an adult if they're between the age of 10 and 19. Now, if a child is under the age of 10, then they are half as infectious as an adult, but they can still transmit the virus. So in other words, even though the number of people who come down with the symptoms of the coronavirus is small for children, children can be carriers of the virus and infect other people perhaps just as much as adults can. Now, this is a cause for concern, of course, because school is starting up. Children are already lining up in many districts around the country. And the question is, how safe is it? Well, many scientists believe the inevitable is going to happen. There will be an increase in the infection rate in the population as more children go back to school, especially among children from the age of 10 to 19, as they spread the virus just like adults. Well, first of all, let me say that if you are in that situation where you have to make a choice, please consult a professional, your doctor, a scientist. I am not a biologist. I am not an epidemiologist. My PhD is in theoretical physics. However, physics is where computer modeling was created. We physicists are the ones who created the equations which make computer modeling possible. And all the computer models show that as we relax our guard, more children are going to school, more college students go to the university, we're going to see an uptick in the number of infections and the number of deaths. Because children, yes, they are vulnerable. Not as vulnerable as adults, but yes, they are vulnerable. So at this point, it becomes a societal and political decision. How much are you willing to pay for an education? How much are you willing to pay to be safe from the virus? Like I said, consult your doctor, consult a health professional, and then make up your own mind. Personally, I have my doubts as to whether it is a good idea to send so many children back to school when the proper safeguards are not there. For example, you've probably seen the TV reports of children going back to school, and they have a thermometer testing people's temperature right on the spot. Well, that may make a good soundbite, but scientifically speaking, 50%, up to 50% of the people who are infected are non-symptomatic. And so 50% of the time, you're not going to get a good reading simply by monitoring people's temperature as a consequence. And given the fact that the virus will hit the schools, the children will then bring the virus back home to mom and dad, to grandpa and grandma, and they are more susceptible to the virus than the adults are. Well, scientists have asked the question, why is it that there's so much variability in the infection rate? Some people get infected by the virus and come out smelling like a rose. They are asymptomatic. In fact, up to 50% of those people who are infected are asymptomatic. And we're beginning to understand a little bit of the reason why. You see, the coronavirus is shaped like the corona of the sun. That's where the name comes from. It has spikes coming out of the surface of the virus. And these spikes are like keys. These keys fit into a lock on the cell wall of the mucous membranes of your nose, for example. And that lock is called the ACE2. It turns out that the coronavirus key exactly fits that lock, unlocks the door, and thereby allows it to get entry into your cell to hijack the reproductive mechanisms of the cell to make thousands of copies of itself, which will eventually kill you. But it turns out that the number of ACE2 receptors varies with age. It turns out that children, when you analyze the number of ACE2 receptors, do not have that many compared to adults. However, even though that may be good news, another study that came out recently showed that for children over 10 years of age, the teenagers, they are just as likely as adults to spread the coronavirus. And so the danger is not necessarily so much among the children themselves, because they have fewer ACE2 receptors in their nose. The danger comes when they bring the virus home to mom and dad, grandma and grandpa, and they are much more susceptible to the virus than the children are. Another mystery that's gradually being solved is, why is it that some adults seem to be totally asymptomatic? When you take a look at the blood of these individuals, previously, we only looked at whether or not the COVID antibodies were there or not. Now we're looking at T cells. You see, we have more than one layer of immunity in our bodies. We have the ability to create antibodies, but also T cells circulate in the blood, and they also act as sentries to prevent the body from being infected. And lo and behold, it turns out that people who have no exposure to the virus at all, people analyzed in geologically isolated areas with no contact with tourists, no contact with the outside world, we find out that their T cells can recognize the coronavirus. This was rather surprising, but in hindsight, we now realize that it turns out that when your body manufactures T cells to attack a common cold, the common cold, some of them are caused by coronaviruses, not of course COVID-19, but nonetheless, your body is primed to recognize certain varieties of the coronavirus. So in other words, by accident, you have a built-in immunity to some degree of the coronavirus because you have T cells that are primed because your body has been exposed to the common cold, the flu, and other kinds of diseases. Now, of course, this is not for everyone, but it does partially solve a mystery. Why is it that some people have mild symptoms or asymptomatic or eventually die? It's because, in part, because of the number of ACE2 receptors in their nose, for example, and the exposure to the body of previous coronaviruses, which have generated T cells circulating in your blood, which can then recognize this variety of the coronavirus. So one by one, some of the information concerning the coronavirus is being revealed. Also, there's some good news here. As we reported on Exploration, even though we don't have a vaccine, we have therapeutics that are advancing very rapidly. In fact, not just one, two, but a whole variety of therapeutics. First of all, we have convalescent antibodies that are extracted from the blood of people that have recovered after being infected by the coronavirus. However, the problem there is that a person that's been infected can only donate so much of their plasma for the next person who's been infected. Why not clone? Why not clone the antibodies? And now that's what we are doing. Using biotechnology, scientists can now take the antibodies recovered from somebody who has recovered from the coronavirus and clone it, duplicate it, to create as much plasma, convalescent plasma, as we want. This could be a tremendous first step toward controlling the virus because we don't have to depend upon people getting the disease, recovering from the disease, and then extracting antibodies from their blood in limited quantities. In some sense, we can create unlimited quantities of the antibody. Next, we have remdesivir, which can lessen the severity of the disease. Remdesivir was first used against Ebola, but because of the so-called buckshot effect, if an antiviral works against one virus, it will also work against other viruses as well. This is rather unexpected. We didn't realize that an antiviral used against one virus can be used for a totally unrelated virus, because they share maybe some of the same biochemical mechanisms which allow them to reproduce. So now scientists are looking at different varieties of chemicals like remdesivir. And then the big breakthrough was dexamethasone. Dexamethasone actually reduces for the first time the death rate coming from the coronavirus. Because what kills you is not the virus at all. What kills you is the cytokine storm, the overreaction of the body. The body overreacts and attacks itself. That's why you die from the coronavirus in the main. It's a steroid. Dexamethasone is a rather common steroid, costs only about $1 a day, and scientists are now experimenting with other different kinds of steroids as well that can lessen the inflammation. That is, lessen the body going into overdrive as it basically kills itself in the process of trying to kill the coronavirus. Also, good news on the vaccine front. Many people realize that, yes, all the trials so far done by major laboratories that have spent hundreds of millions of dollars in trials, they're coming out all good. So it means that we may make the deadline, perhaps end of this year, early next year, having a vaccine ready. But to stimulate the creation of a proper vaccine, 30,000 people have volunteered. Get this. 30,000 people have volunteered to be deliberately infected by the coronavirus to see whether these vaccines work. This is amazing. You see, right now we're undergoing phase 3 trials. That means tens of thousands of people get the vaccine, but another group are not told, and they're not given the vaccine. They're given a placebo. So without their knowledge, they don't know whether they have the vaccine or not. And then you simply calculate, due to interactions every day, how many will get the virus and how many will die. Well, that's kind of a tedious process because you simply have to wait because one half has the vaccine, one half does not, but they don't know which half they are in. Now we have 30,000 individuals who have volunteered to deliberately allow themselves to take the vaccine and then be exposed to the virus. This could vastly increase the accuracy and the time necessary to create a vaccine. So that's good news. Also, speaking about vaccines, there was a disturbing report that came out recently showing that perhaps even if you are vaccinated, perhaps the effect will only last for just a few months, like 3 months. That's always possible. But there was also another disturbing report showing that people that were infected with the virus and then were, quote, recovered from the infection can get reinfected again a few months later. Now, that is very disconcerting because perhaps it means that you can get the virus twice, one after the other, by being exposed to the virus. However, we have to take some of these reports with a grain of salt. Some critics have now analyzed the data, and they realize that even if a person had an infection with the virus, perhaps they weren't really cured of it. Perhaps it was simply the virus in remission. In other words, it was the same virus that caused the initial infection and then another infection later on, giving the impression that the person did not have antibody protection. Therefore, it means that perhaps vaccinations will also be circumspect as a consequence, and that maybe the long-term effects of the vaccines could be short-lived. Well, the upshot of all this is that this is news as it happens. The media, of course, seized upon some of these facts. However, we have to look at other studies, much larger studies, and many scientists who have analyzed the data say that it's simply unreliable, that there's still a very good chance that the vaccination will last much longer than 3 months, and that once you get the virus, the chance of getting it again is extremely small, and that you have to question the data. The data is simply not that reliable. And so scientists are simply shaking their heads and saying, it's a learning curve. We're still learning a lot about the virus as we go along. We're not making it up. Simply, we don't have the data. Because, of course, scientists were caught flat-footed just a few months ago when this virus seemed to pop literally out of nowhere. However, we should also point out that among all the chaos caused by the coronavirus, the northeast of the United States, from Florida, in fact, all the way up to Canada, was hit pretty hard by hurricane season. Power blackouts, trees going down, houses collapsing, roofs being ripped up, beachfront property being ruined, all because of the fact that this year, 2020, could come down as the worst hurricane season in several decades. So brace yourself. This could be the beginning of a new hurricane season. And the question is, what's behind it? Well, first of all, you have to know where hurricanes come from and where they derive their energy. Most hurricanes come from the coast of Africa. They're small breezes But they worked their way across the Atlantic because of the churning of atmospheric winds. But as they get closer to the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean, they encounter warm water. Warm water is where the energy of a hurricane comes from. So as the mild breeze from Africa goes across the Atlantic, hits the Gulf of Mexico, it encounters warm water, and it starts to rise because that's what hot air does. And the air beneath it spins because of the spin of the Earth. And that's why hurricanes have a counterclockwise spin. They get their energy from the temperature of the Gulf of Mexico. And we know that several contributing factors are making it worse. First of all, the temperature of the Caribbean is a few degrees higher than normal in certain spots, meaning that there's more energy to build the hurricane with. Well, the National Weather Bureau has some rather stark predictions for 2020. In fact, meteorologists say that this year could be the worst year in terms of hurricanes in the 37-year history since the United States began to track these hurricanes. So the predictions for 2020 are grim. 24 named storms will hit the United States. These are storms that are severe enough to be given names. 12 of them will be hurricanes, and of them, 5 of them will be major hurricanes. The bad news is, this could be the worst hurricane season since the year 2005, in which we had Katrina and Wilma, and we know the kind of devastation that was caused by Katrina, which of course hit New Orleans and devastated that city. Not to mention the fact that the U.S. government makes an estimate of the chances of a monster Category 3 or higher hurricane hitting the continental United States. So it's like a crapshoot. That number is 75%. In other words, there's a 75% chance that the continental United States can be walloped by a giant hurricane. And then the next question is, why? Why do we have predictions of a monstrous hurricane season? Well, in some sense, it's a perfect storm for hurricanes. First of all, one of the driving factors is the warmer waters of the Caribbean and the Atlantic. In fact, in part because of global warming, there's been a 2-degree rise in temperature that's been cataloged over the last several decades. Warm water means more energy for hurricanes. That's the first reason. The second reason is the rainfall in Africa is much wetter than normal. And usually, wetter seasons means more energy and more rain for hurricanes. Next, low pressure areas are building up. And low pressure areas encourage the churning of the atmosphere to create a hurricane. And last, we have La Niña. La Niña is the opposite of El Niño. And these are periodic warming and coolings of the oceans. And so we have this perfect storm of warmer waters of the Caribbean, a wetter atmosphere in off the coast of Africa, low pressure areas building up, and La Niña. So brace yourself. This could just be the beginning. More downed trees, more blackouts, more collapsed homes, more chaos caused by hurricane season. And just remember that even though the principal driver may not be one thing like global warming, when you put it all together, the United States could be walloped by a hurricane season that we haven't seen since the year 2005. And speaking about global warming, the lockdown that the entire world has experienced in the last several months has had, in some sense, a bizarre silver lining to it. And that is because of the collapse of most economies throughout the planet Earth, it meant that, well, pollution and global warming is taking a setback. In other words, the computer models that we have predicting the amount of pollution, predicting the amount of carbon dioxide, predicting the increase in temperatures, can all be tested because we have this huge laboratory now, which is the economic activity of the entire United States. Now, let me be very clear about one point. Some people would like to jump to conclusions and say, aha, this hurricane season is proof that global warming is correct. Well, yes and no. You see, global warming is an average effect. You cannot point to one particular snowfall, one particular drought, one particular flood and say, aha, that's the fingerprint of global warming. Global warming takes place on a scale of years to decades, even centuries. And as a consequence, it's very difficult to say that one storm, one event is due to global warming. On average, you could say that. On average, you could say that the fact that we have so many 100-year storms, so many 100-year floods, so many 100-year fires, we can see the fingerprint of global warming. But you cannot say that one particular season was caused by global warming. Let me give you another example. In winter times, we sometimes realize that winters are more severe than normal. And some people say, aha, that disproves global warming because winters should be milder. And here we are having more severe winters. Well, not so fast. You see, first of all, much of the weather in the northern part of the planet is governed by the polar vortex. The polar vortex is like a tornado sitting right on top of the North Pole, and it's usually quite stable. Now, the polar vortex looks like a cone sitting on top of the North Pole, spinning very rapidly, and it's quite stable. The temperature difference between the inside of the cone and the outside temperature is rather large, and that helps to keep the cone stable so the cone doesn't wobble, causing snowstorms in all directions. However, because of global warming, the pressure differential between the inside and the outside of the cone is decreasing, which means that the cone is becoming unstable, is wandering. If you take a look at maps of the North Pole showing the region governed by the polar vortex, you see that it wanders now. It's not as stable as it used to be because of global warming. And that's one of the reasons why we have these monster snowstorms when they shouldn't be that way, because of the fact that the polar vortex is more unstable. Therefore, you cannot, again, say that one particular monster snowstorm was caused by global warming, but it's an average effect. That averaged over years, you can see that the wobbling of the polar vortex causes the erratic weather during wintertime, and the warming of the Caribbean causes the erratic hurricane season, but all these are average effects. Well, that concludes the first part of Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and you're listening to Exploration. Well, everyone's talking about the coronavirus, but the economy, of course, has collapsed around the world, and for scientists, in some weird sense, this has given us an ability to computer check our models. We have computer models that show that as economic activity diminishes, then you also diminish the amount of carbon dioxide released in the atmosphere. And the coronavirus tragedy has allowed us to check some of these computer programs. Well, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to continue this discussion with climatologist and scientist Peter Ward, author of a disturbing book called Flooded Earth. What happens when we go back to normal again? Will the ice caps eventually melt? This is the question we're going to ask in the second half of Exploration. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of exploration, we talked about the first wave, second wave, and perhaps even third wave of infections from the coronavirus and the tremendous havoc that it has created throughout the entire planet Earth. Scientists, however, have seen this in some bizarre way as an opportunity to check some of our computer models. Because with a decrease in economic activity, you also have a decrease in the production of carbon dioxide, and therefore a slowing down of the greenhouse effect. And sure enough, preliminary computer studies seem to vindicate this. Well, of course, this is just temporary. The economy will come roaring back, who knows when, and perhaps in the next few years. But it means that once again, unless we make the transition to a solar hydrogen era, we're going to go back to normal again, spewing out tremendous amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, thereby heating up the planet. Well, what could happen in a worst-case scenario? In a worst-case scenario, you're going to see the polar ice caps begin to crack, melt, break apart, and we're already seeing the beginnings of this in the North Polar region, and satellite photographs from the South Polar region show that, yes, fissures and cracks are forming even there. So with us in the second half of exploration is Professor Peter Ward, author of a disturbing book called The Flooded Earth, about what happens after the coronavirus ends, what happens when we go back to normal again, and spew enormous amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Professor Ward, you're a professor of biology and Earth and space science at the University of Washington in Seattle. However, as a youth, what steered you in the direction of science?
Well, thanks so much for having me. And I think scientists know from an early age that they're going to be scientists, so it was indeed youth. What got me going were dinosaurs. My mother and father were from New York. I grew up in Seattle. We didn't have a single dinosaur skeleton. And so I was given this guilt treatment that I had to be in Seattle, and it's my fault or something that there were no dinosaur skeletons. But that got me going.
Okay. And that set you off. And how did you get interested in astronomy and Earth and space science?
Well, I certainly started in paleontology, so I was looking at my feet all the time down at the ground. But it became evident, I think, in the first part of this century, or really the end of the 20th century, that there was a great deal to learn about life in space, and especially how other Earths could be constructed from what we knew in our own Earth history. And so deep Earth history can inform us about astrobiology, and in the book I've just done now, it is deep Earth history, which can inform us about what climate change is capable of.
Okay, well, the book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. So let's start with the ice caps. The North Polar region, over the past 50 years, since submarines have visited the North Pole, seems to have decreased by 50% just in the last 50 years. So what is your projection of the North Pole and also Greenland going into the future?
Well, the great dream of the Europeans coming to North America was for the Northwest Passage. I mean, this was a driving impulse to try to find a quick trade route to China. We're going to have that. But what really I really didn't understand thoroughly enough was the difference between an ice cap and an ice sheet. All of the North Polar ice cap can melt away, and it will have no effect, essentially, on sea level. It is the ice on land, the ice sheets, which are the biggest of which, of course, are Greenland and in Antarctica. Anything that melts on those goes directly into the ocean and raises the level of it. And the biggest, scariest scenario is equivalent to what we call an ice sheet collapse. So imagine you have a cup of really warm water and then dump in about 10 or 15 ice cubes. And up goes the level of that water really fast. Well, that is the scenario for an ice sheet collapse in Antarctica.
Okay, well, we've heard about what's happening in the North Polar region, but in the South Pole, we have huge chunks of ice breaking off. But what does that mean, given the fact that most of the South Pole seems stable, at least temporarily?
You know, I've come back from two separate trips to Antarctica over the last 2 years, and we're looking at deep time events of the climate down there, but you can't help but notice what's going on all around you. It was melting like crazy. when you have both kinds of ice down there. You've got floating ice, which, again, if that melts, doesn't matter. But you've also got all this ice on land. When it melts, the water goes down to the ice rock contact, of course, and that acts as a lubricant. So when you have really anomalous warming, stuff that is on the edge of this can calve off into the ocean. That causes great global change in terms of sea level rise.
Okay, and talking about sea level rise, doesn't the heating of the Earth itself cause expansion of warm water, which causes the sea level to rise? Just the sheer fact that the Earth is warming up.
It sure does. And matter of fact, if we stopped all emissions right now, we just went completely emission neutral, the ocean is still going to rise in its level because of thermal expansion. There's been so much warming already that the ocean has a lag effect, but over the next 40, 50 years, we could expect nearly a 3-foot sea level rise if, based on the temperatures that we have now and the continued warming, from the thermal expansion, no ice at all.
Okay, 3-foot rise without any ice, and I guess for every 1-foot vertical that you lose, how much horizontal seacoast do you lose?
Well, the seacoast itself is affected more strongly by storm surge. And you can think of storm surge as equivalent to going off a diving board. You jump off a diving board at a given height, but if you bounce a couple of times, you go way higher. It's as if you have a launching platform as sea level rises. The storm surge, which are the nasty big waves that rise higher than normal sea level, can hit coasts. But the sideways movement of the ocean is far more serious in terms of what its salt does. Salt goes laterally quite easily, and depending on the type of soil, it is the salinization of the sea level crops that I think is the greatest single danger from sea level rise. It's stunning how much of the world's productivity, and especially the rice regions in Southeast Asia, are on deltas. A delta is built out from a river hitting a calm ocean. If you have a 3-foot sea level rise, every delta on this planet will disappear. We're talking about the Nile, the Brahmaputra, the Mekong, and these are all enormously productive areas. So this is the big blow that is coming. The equation is we're going to have a rise in sea level at the same time we have a rise in human population. As you know, we're at 6.6 billion now, but we're heading towards 9 billion. And this, too, is built into the system. It's kind of like the warmth of the ocean. We could do tremendous birth control efforts now, but we're probably still going to hit that 9 billion. So the intersection of 9 billion with reduced agricultural yields because of the sea level rise is the scariest aspect.
Okay, well, let's assume that we do nothing. That is, we simply treat everything as normal. We keep on spewing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Let's take the world 2050. In 2050, what will coastal cities like Boston, New York, Miami, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, what will they look like if we just keep spewing carbon dioxide in the air as if there was nothing wrong? And we project 50 years into the future.
Well, 2050 is still not going to be apparent that we're in a crisis. It's kind of like watching a speed car as it leaves the Indy 500. If you catch it in the first 10 feet or so, it's not going very fast. But acceleration is an interesting thing. It will be apparent to all city planners in 2050 that something new is going on, and they won't like it. Much of city infrastructure is now buried. People put down obviously all the sewage, but now so much of the electrical and advanced communication systems are underground. They were not engineered for salt water. They were engineered for fresh water. Bringing a lot of salt into city infrastructure is going to be a huge headache. It's also going to be a headache for trying to keep freshwater reservoirs going and freshwater aquifers. So 2050 is the time when the alarm bells are going to be ringing. The populace isn't going to see much. It might only be a foot rise by then, but certainly there will be urban red lights going off like crazy.
Well, in New York City, a few years ago, we had a gigantic nor'easter which sent a surge of water into Manhattan, which flooded the subway system. And it was not even a very big storm that did that. And some people think that storm surges, even before sea level rise goes to catastrophic levels, storm surges could paralyze the electrical, the plumbing system, and the infrastructure of a city. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, storm surge is definitely the most dangerous short-term effect of this. Look, we saw what storm surge did to New Orleans. It wasn't so much the hurricane itself, Katrina, that battered New Orleans. It was the storm surge. And once again, your storm surge comes from a mean sea level. When you keep raising that mean sea level, storm surge goes up, way up, higher. The most endangered creatures are therefore freshwater plants. And what I really break in my heart is try to think what's going to happen to the Everglades. You've got this enormous freshwater biosystem, which will be so threatened by both storm surge and simply rise in sea level. You cannot live in salt water if you're a freshwater plant. And unfortunately, no saltwater plant, like a mangrove, makes food that humans can eat.
Hmm. Something to think about. Now let's turn the wheels of time to 2100. What will the great cities of the world look like in 2100?
Well, 2100, there will be 3 feet, only 3 feet if we're lucky, and 5 to 6 feet if we're not lucky. And by lucky, I mean we turn off the lights right now. If it is business as usual, and I suspect it might be because of the increased population numbers, there will be that 3 to 5 foot. The most hard hit will be the wharves. Global transport by ship is still the main means of moving great amounts of food around. CNN projected when I was in Antarctica a few months ago that even a 1 foot rise in sea level will cause shipping terminals and ports and docks and dock heights to have to be modified. And their projection was $1 trillion or more by about 2040 just to spend on the docks. Now, San Francisco Airport, I've landed on that airport over and over and over. A 3 to 5 foot sea level rise in the Bay Area will remove that airport entirely. And so just from the economic points of view, that 3 to 5 foot sea level is going to cause such an enormous financial burden on coastal cities.
Okay, the big question, will cities have to be abandoned if sea levels continue to rise 3 to 5 feet? And which cities are we talking about?
Well, we've done a lot of projections on this, and I've been talking to some Dutch engineers. The consensus, and again, this is really just consensus of people looking forward, is that civilization and the cities now could probably absorb a 3 foot, 4 foot, even at the worst case scenario, a 5 foot sea level rise and survive. But anything above 5 to 6 feet for a lot of cities is not survivable. New York has high ground. It can simply move back, but Miami cannot. Miami is, I think, the poster child of the type of city that will disappear, as Galveston, Texas will, much of the South Florida cities will, and the Netherlands, of course, is in huge trouble. They already have a significant, I think it's 30% of their land area is already under sea level, and they spend an appreciable amount of their GNP on dikes every year. Dikes and the equivalent of dikes, sometimes big sandbars. When global economy gets hit hard, it affects everybody, and I think that's what's coming.
Well, what about Boston? Large parts of Boston were reclaimed since the Revolutionary War. If you look at old maps of Boston, large parts of Boston didn't exist until recently. So what's going to happen to Boston?
Yeah, all reclaimed parts of cities are going to go away. The same with my city of Seattle. Our entire bay, Elliott Bay it's called, there's an island. Our major shipping port is an island built up from reclaimed sediment, just as Boston is. And once again, the 3 foot sea level rise allows storm surge, the big storms, to come whipping in and remove a lot of that sediment. You're not going to be able to hold that together. So any city with reclaimed sediment construction. And lots of the airports in Asia, and especially in Japan, they've been building airports out on the water. China's just done it too. All those things will have to be rebuilt somewhere else.
And what about San Francisco, Los Angeles, and especially what's going to happen to New Orleans, where large parts of the city are actually under sea level?
I think New Orleans will have to be abandoned ultimately. It might be a century or two. San Francisco is very interesting. They're very progressive engineers down there. And believe it or not, they have a plan for building a dam right under the Golden Gate Bridge that would save every one of the Bay Cities. You could hold off sea level rise by building this dam. Otherwise, it's going to be a whole series of smaller dikes and systems and try to save what you can and lose what otherwise. Los Angeles is in an interesting position, too, because the city itself has obviously a lot of high ground, but there are very low-lying areas in Los Angeles that, again, will be inundated to the point that some huge storm comes, salt water is pushed way inland through storm surge, killing off the plants that are there. And then what do you do when you're living in a house that is flooded out by not freshwater, salt water? A saltwater flooding event is way worse than a freshwater flooding event.
And what about London, where we have gigantic underwater devices to help control the water of the Thames River? Are we all going to be like that? Are we all going to be like the little Dutch boy putting our finger in gigantic dikes that we're going to build around our cities? What are we going to do about this?
Well, the British have thought a lot about sea level rise, too, and they are planning on contingencies for up to 5 feet. And you just really hit it. They're thinking about what sort of engineering do we have to do to save our cities? Historic cities such as London and any of the cities in the Mediterranean will do everything and anything to try to keep their shorelines as they are now. But it really all depends on where we can stop this. Look, if we melt every single glacier on the planet, we have a sea level rise of over 200 feet. That was the case less than 17,000 years ago. We know from the deep past that when carbon dioxide has been 1,000 parts per million, there is no ice sheet. And we're at 380, 390 and climbing. It's just that to me is the spookiest aspect of it all.
Okay. And what's going to happen to growing areas of the world? Like California has the San Joaquin Valley. Other places have gigantic growing areas. What happens when salt water begins to intrude upon these growing areas?
Agriculture becomes very dicey. Obviously, the San Joaquin Valley is enormously threatened. 20 years ago, it was already recognized that there's salt creeping in. Once again, if sea level goes up a little, salt goes sideways a whole lot. And if any sort of salt within your soil reduces productivity and ends to the point that you can no longer grow crop plants. So this San Joaquin Valley itself is endangered. The northern Sacramento Valley is in trouble. And as I mentioned earlier, every delta on the planet and all that rice from Southeast Asia, those are the targeted places that we should worry about most agriculturally.
Okay. And well, let's be very specific. I live in Manhattan. Manhattan is a little bit above sea level. The place where I am is about, I don't know, 15, 20 feet above sea level. However, certain parts of Manhattan are very close to sea level. Wall Street, for example. So what is Manhattan going to look like? And are we going to have to use a system of dikes to prevent the flooding of Manhattan?
Yeah, there will have to be some sort of mitigation going on in Manhattan. If not for the sea level rise itself, certainly for the storm surge. Again, a small level storm surge is the takeoff point for a small level of sea level rise is the takeoff point for storm surge. And in my book, I actually did some elevation counts for various areas and various streets in New York. And not off the top of my head, I actually projected winners and losers in mm-hmm. New York City and its boroughs.
Okay. And let's talk about Venice. Engineers have seriously looked at the problem of Venice. San Marco Plaza, the famous plaza, is actually underwater for parts of the year. So what have we learned by trying to do these gigantic engineering projects like for Venice?
Well, Venice is really interesting because they're putting out into the bay that Venice faces what is sort of a non-traditional dike in a way. It's not like a single wall that the little Dutch boy can put his finger in. But what is interesting and sort of alarming for Venice is also in Holland, it's not just the sea level rise, but it's the fact that the rivers behind yourself. These big cities were often built upon rivers. And because we've got global warming, it's not snowing in many of the mountains, in the Alps and in the Sierra, for instance, snow level is higher. And so instead of snowing in the winter, it rains. And these rivers rise at times they never used to rise before. So Venice is fighting a two-front war, as is many of the Dutch cities. You have to worry about the river that runs through you as much as the sea coming at you. And as any of the military geniuses said, two-front wars are often hard to win.
So Venice may have to be abandoned at some point, you figure?
I would suspect, yes.
Okay, and your book goes beyond 2100, goes to 2300 and beyond. So what is the coastline of the world going to look like now beyond 2100? If I have a map of the world, what will school children see? The North Pole gone, the coastline changing. What will the Earth look like beyond 2100?
Well, it really boils down to some simple geology. Continents, as we know, move around. In the direction that they move, like North America's west coast, there are high mountains generally. But trailing edges, we call them passive edges, don't have mountains, or they have mountains that eroded away, as our east coast does. So you've got the enormous Gulf Plain, you've got the enormous east coast plain in front of the Appalachians. There'll be inroads all through that. The problem that we see is that most estimates and models think up to 2100 and stop. But at 2100, if it's business as usual, say we kept it at 3 feet, it doesn't stop there. It keeps going in accelerated fashion. So if you have 3 to 5 feet by 2100, it's not going to mean that you would have twice that by 2200. You could have three times that high. The acceleration is the most ominous aspect of this business.
So let's just do a computer program. Assume that at some point we stop greenhouse gases into the future, but we just let the computer program run. What will the world look like? Will all the great cities be underwater by then, by 2200, 2300?
No, ice sheets in Antarctica, they are thinning, and they're thinning in both Greenland and Antarctica. A great deal of that water is going in, but the ice sheets are enormously thick in both places. Greenland is far more endangered than Antarctica is. You're not going to see a wholesale flooding of the cities by 2200 or even 2300, which possibly gives us time, but you're certainly going to see effects where the cities that will have to be abandoned, I think that will already be taking place. We just have to maintain these ice sheets with as much integrity as we can, and that means slowing the global warming temperatures, which seem to be inexorable. Look, we just went through this huge recession. We should have had 2 or 3 years because of the economic downturn, when emissions could have been or should have been reduced, they weren't. I mean, they're right up at the IPCC's maximum emission predictions. We're not lowering emissions. We're increasing emissions.
Okay, now let's go into the past. You can do that because we can drill into the ice cap and get ice cores from thousands of years ago. 10,000 years ago, we had the Ice Age. It was very cold, 10,000 years and beyond that. So how far back in time do you have to go to find a time similar to what we're going to be experiencing in the future? And what did the world look like at that time?
Well, the conventional answer is that if we get up to 1,000 parts per million, which would happen in 2 centuries from now, if we have some sort of control on emissions, a lot of us think that 1,000 parts per million would be a lot sooner than that. But you are going all the way back to a time called the Eocene. And the Eocene was a very interesting time when we had crocodiles up on the North Pole. We had palm trees in Seattle. We just had this wonderfully tropical climate. The bad news is that sea level was 240 feet higher than it is now because there was no ice. There were no ice sheets at all on the planet.
And when was that?
This was about 50 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But we only have to go back 110,000 years ago to see a world where sea level was at least 10 feet higher than now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's great evidence of this in Florida. In the Florida Keys, there's a beautiful quarry in Windley Key. It's a national park. And you can see big coral heads sitting 4 or 5 feet above sea level. Now, if you go offshore with your mask and flippers, you find the same corals, big Montastria they're called, living down about 10 feet deep. That's the shallowest they can live. So here is evidence, and we can date these with radiometric dating, that 105, 110,000 years ago, sea level was 10 feet higher than it is now, and the entire geography of that place was different. What caused that short-term rise, and this was a blip in the Ice Age, was orbital changes. But at the same time, we had a slight increase in carbon dioxide, and these two conspired to cause a great melt enough to produce a 10-foot rise in sea level.
Well, that concludes our interview with Professor Peter Ward, author of a disturbing new book called Flooded Earth, about a worst-case scenario. What happens if the greenhouse effect runs amok, unabated, that the nations of the world simply refuse to see the dangers of global warming? What happens then? Well, like a canary in the mineshaft, the first signal will be the melting of the ice caps. This has already begun. We're seeing a thawing out of parts of the tundra of Canada and Alaska and Siberia, and cracks are beginning to form in the South Polar region. And nuclear submarines that have visited the North Pole for the last 50 years have seen a drop by 50% in the last 50 years. That's a 1% drop in the thickness of the North Polar ice sheet, 1% per year, which means that perhaps in the next 50 years, it'll disappear entirely. And that means, of course, that children will no longer believe in Santa Claus because there is no North Pole for Santa Claus to live. Well, the coronavirus, of course, has wreaked havoc on the economy, created tremendous amount of human suffering, but scientists see this as an opportunity to study what happens when economic activity comes to a grinding halt, meaning that carbon dioxide production also drops, and we can then see the effects of it. And sure enough, computer models are right on the dot, showing that as economic activity decreases, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere also decreases, and we're seeing a slight drop in the temperature of the planet Earth as a consequence. However, once the coronavirus is over, it's going to be back to normal again, full steam ahead as the economy recovers. But hopefully, we've learned a lesson. Hopefully, we'll know that a solar hydrogen era based on electric cars, based on fuel cell engines, based on solar-powered houses, perhaps we'll learn a lesson that a new economy could also be born at the same time. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And also go to my website. It's mkaku.org, mkaku.org, and find out what I'm all about. I've written 4 New York Times bestsellers, and I have radio shows that are broadcast nationwide. So once again, that's it for Exploration.